All right, since we want this flight to be the safest possible journey, let's look at some of the options that are available to us, because as we know, you know, safety is a function of options. You know, when we run out of options, we're painting ourselves into a corner. So clearly we have some different ways to look at this flight. Go, delay, you know, different route. What are some of the priorities here with regard to getting the job done and using the system to its best advantage?
Well, it's really having, as you said, Bob, options. And you need several options. One option highlighted in the particular scenario is landing at Greenville. Perhaps a second or backup option is also appropriate here. And along with those options, I think you need to be familiar with those airports. You need to have the information relative to the airport, airport facility directory type information available to you so that you could make use of the options if needed.
Because you're going to be making choices and decisions while you're in the air. You may start out for Greenville, but may not wind up there.
Absolutely, John.
So make sure you got plenty of fuel. Don't paint yourself in a corner.
Yeah, absolutely. And in this case, the pilot could safely depart Myrtle Beach because he had lots of good weather headed westbound until he got in the Greenville-Nashville area. So there was certainly nothing wrong with that decision to head west and perhaps be prepared to land short, even short of Greenville, if the weather had changed.
Yeah, and the weather is clearly downstream. So as Wally's indicated here, you know, getting started is not a problem. Safely getting started is not a problem at all. So, I mean, you know, getting going in the right direction is, I think, is always a good idea. We always, you know, are inclined to do that. And there's no risk involved with that. So on the first leg to head and to a safe stop, which allows us to then reevaluate, get more information, update the information we have, is really a good thing. So there's really no reason to delay our initial departure. You know, let's get on the road to a safe option where we can reevaluate, and then that's when we have the challenges. So I think that's probably what we're going to look at here. You know, we get halfway. Boy, what do we need now for information, and where do we get it from?
Another thing to enable options, you need to have the approach place to support use of those options. That means, although you might not intend on landing in a particular area and you intend on overflying it, if you do have to land, you need to have the approach place for that airport available to you in the airplane.
One of the caveats of this approach is that you want to be careful not to get too far into that thunderstorm area and not get yourself in a situation where you're landing in an airport as the thunderstorm is approaching. There's an awful lot of hazards associated with that. We all know about wind shear and turbulence and gusts, and sometimes the temptation to move too close to those thunderstorms is there. And rather than try that, you need to perhaps do a 180 and go back to the east, get back out of that system to make a safe landing in the sunshine somewhere.
Well, you raise a terrific point about proximity to thunderstorms. And you and I were talking just yesterday about standards for thunderstorm avoidance. And I, in my military experience, and you in your airline experience, had very definitive parameters for thunderstorm avoidance. And boy, you know, it's nice to have that kind of guidance. And they were pretty broad. I mean, avoid by 10 miles, avoid by 20 miles, okay?
Right.
And yet in the general aviation realm, how many pilots have standards like that? And the truth of the matter is, you don't want to be anywhere near thunderstorms, because even in the proximity of thunderstorms, you can run into the many hazards associated. You can run into hail. You can run into wind shear. You can run into turbulence. You can run into updrafts and downdrafts. So even in the proximity of thunderstorms, we're going to start dealing with the effects, and that's just going to compound our flight to a degree we don't need or want.
Getting back to Wally's point relative to wind shear and gusts, it's important to remember that gust fronts typically precede lines of thunderstorms. Mm-hmm. And you need to be thinking about that.
And can extend out quite a ways in front of the gust front. You may think you're racing the storm to the airport and you're going to be okay. And that's something that in certain airports, anyhow, ATC does have. There's about 45 airports now that have the low-level wind shear alert system. But you can certainly ask ATC to check with the tower. Are they starting to get gusts? Because you may only have an hour-old ATIS. So check with the tower and see if what they're seeing out the window. A lot of times you can do that, too. You know, the airport may be reporting benign weather, but the tower controller is looking at a big black cloud to the north headed towards the field, and that's real-time information. That's stuff that you could use.
John, let's before we get into the onboard equipment, you know, that can help us with thunderstorms, you raise a good point with regard to air traffic. What are some of the pluses and minuses of air traffic? I know a lot of pilots will say, well, you know, air traffic will keep me clear. Well, that's kind of too broad, but you can give us a little bit of insight with regard to what the controller can do and can't do. And, you know, realize that once again, a controller is not there to deal only with you and your thunderstorm problems. And right. That sometimes we can be a little myopic with regard to feeling like, hey, I need help and I need it now.
Right. And the controller can do a lot, but you got to realize that, let's back up a little bit, that ATC radar is designed primarily to detect airplanes. It detects primary targets really well, transponders even better, but it also, depending upon the type of system, whether it's terminal and route, and there's a bunch of different kinds of systems, it depicts precipitation, and that's all it's going to depict. Doesn't depict clouds, doesn't depict turbulence, although some of the later systems can depict wind shear, that's not what's displayed on the controller's display. Given that, the controller can do a lot within the limitations of the airspace and within the limitations of how much room you've got to work. If you've worked yourself into a blind canyon, there's nothing a controller can do to get you out of it. If there's a cell that the controller is painting, controller is required to tell you about it and there's specific phraseology that they have to do in order to advise you of that. And they can give you a vector around it and they can give you some advice or clearance to a fix or a reroute that's going to take you around it. But it's such a dynamic situation and it can change very, very quickly. There's many times you start vectoring somebody towards a hole and the hole closes up. Or the line starts moving, things start developing behind where you are, and there's just no place to go. So it's one of a list of many tools that you can use. And the busier it gets, the less time that you're going to have on a frequency to be able to do that kind of stuff too.
So, and I think that's one of the real keys is that it really does compound the controller's duties to kind of have him focusing on your weather problem rather than him controlling the big picture situation, which is a lose-lose rather than a win-win.
Right.
Okay, so looking at some of the equipment we have in our airplanes, pilots can confidently get into an airplane now because they have storm scope, they have data link. But obviously there's limits to what this equipment can do for us and can't do. So let's take a little look at that and discuss some of the pros and cons of the equipment and understand just what it's giving us and what it can't. What about the time delays, Wally, with regard to the feedback we're getting, and how that might affect our decisions?
Well, the storm scope, of course, is real time, but anything we're getting on the GPSs and XM weather could be 6, 8, 10, 12 minutes old. And thunderstorms are so dynamic, it's worthwhile to look at it and use it for planning purposes, but not worthwhile for tactical maneuvering around thunderstorms.
It's true. I mean, we have to accept that it's old information, and what good is old information? And once again, big picture decisions, yes, but as far as what's developing there in front of me, it's really not doing much for you. Storm scopes, Bob?
Storm scopes are great. They're terrific for planning your route across country. Typically, the problem with storm scopes is ranging errors. The algorithms in the storm scope assume a certain strength of lightning strike, and they use that to depict a range. Now, all lightning strikes aren't the same intensity, so therefore, there's difference in ranging as it shows on the screen. So it's best to use a storm scope to modify your route when you're 50 or 100 miles away from the cells that are being depicted that might cause you to change your routing to avoid the area, period. Regarding data link, typically the data link depiction of the precip does not correspond with the onboard radar in the airplane. I see this all the time. The onboard radar is real time. The data link might be 10 or 15 minutes old, conceivably, and if the storms are moving at 35 or 40 knots, the position is going to be markedly different from the real world, what's shown on the radar. Using onboard radar in the airplane allows you to approach storms tactically. The data link does not because of the time delay. You can't be sure where the storms are. Again, the data link is great for planning your route. You're 50 or 100 miles away from the cells. This will allow you to see approximately where the storm system is, and it may cause you to change your route, or it may cause you to land, to put the airplane on the ground based on what you see there. But I would never attempt to tactically approach and navigate around storms using Datalink.
Bob, yesterday you mentioned the difference between Datalink lightning strike information and StormScope lightning strike information.
Yes. So Datalink lightning strikes are typically air-to-ground strikes. The StormScope depicts more generally cloud-to-cloud. So you're seeing two different things. If you were to rely upon your Datalink lightning strikes, if there's not much going on cloud-to-ground, you're not going to see very much on the Datalink. The storm scope would, on the other hand, depict cloud to cloud, which may exist at that time.
So, you know, we've talked about what ATC can do for us, and there's some pluses and minuses there. We've looked at the onboard equipment, and once again, there's some real good information it can feed us. A source that a lot of people neglect is the flight service station, which can give us tremendous information. I mean, there's a guy sitting there with the best technology available to us. John, what might we get with a radio call to FlightWatch?
Well, in this scenario, I think one of the things I would do would be almost as soon as I take off out of Myrtle, I'd ask for a frequency change and call FlightWatch and get an update on what's happening. The special is there, has access to all the weather products, different radars, you know, METARs, TAFs. He's got the convective models, AIRMITs, SIGMITs, and PIREPs, which are really important too. PIREPs are a really important way of keeping track of how good is the forecast. If all of a sudden we're starting to see buildups or turbulence in an area where it wasn't forecast or it's moving ahead of schedule. So those are the kind of things that in this, especially in a scenario like this, I'd probably be off frequency two or three times before I even got to Greenville and say, yeah, you know, I just got an update a half hour ago. What's it looking like now?
And that's 122.0.
And what a tool. And boy, I used to, at seminars, I'd look across the room and I'd say, how many of you have talked to FlightWatch in the last 6 months, you know? And you'd see three or four hands go up. And everybody doesn't have storm scopes in Datalink, but everybody, you know, has access to FlightWatch.
And
it's
a great tool. We've kind of downplayed the role of flight service a lot with people being able to do internet filing of flight plans, internet self-briefing, the onboard stuff. Some people look at it as kind of antiquated. And for a situation like this, I think it's a great tool.
So, Bob, if you're a pilot and you don't have all this onboard equipment and you want to contact FlightWatch, what's the proper way to do that?
Well, you would contact FlightWatch by using the name of the Air Route Traffic Control Center that you're working with, for instance, Jacksonville or Washington, and follow that with your aircraft identification, November XYZ, and the name of the nearest VOR to your location. This allows the specialist working FlightWatch to use the appropriate transmitter to communicate with you.
And I'll tell you one thing, I'll just add on to that. I just strongly encourage people to use this system. Call 122.0. It's kind of like having your own dispatcher, you know, and the airlines use it. Why not use the system that's out there for you and can provide you real updated information, you know, when you need it. And there's plenty of dead time when you're flying along, and that's a great time to
update your information. Brings up another point, Bob. There's plenty of dead time when you're en route, in the en route phase. And if your frequency is not very busy, that you're working with ATC, use your number two radio and set it up on FlightWatch, turn the volume down, and just monitor the communications there. You might pick up some tidbits as to what's going on without even asking.
The other thing that's really good to do is when you're talking to FlightWatch, regardless of what the weather is to give PIREPs. Controllers are required to, under certain conditions, to solicit a PIREP hourly. And a negative PIREP can be just as useful as a positive PIREP. If something is forecast and the forecast doesn't come out as expected and you're not encountering the weather that was forecast, that can be even more useful sometimes than confirming that the forecast is there.
And I think we would be negligent here if we didn't talk just a little bit about thunderstorms for a second, because truly, thunderstorms are killers in their worst sense. They're violent entities, and truly, I think it's imperative that pilots truly understand the nature of thunderstorms before they get anywhere near them or even think about messing with them, okay? They're very complicated. They're very powerful. And the adverse effects are unbelievable. You know, we have hail, we have wind shear, we have microbursts, and they extend for miles and miles. So let's just look at those and how they might impact us. And, you know, God forbid we ever find ourselves amidst these things. But I think if we have the proper respect and understanding of them, I think it'll help us avoid them and realize we don't want anything to do with them.
That brings you back to the distance to maintain safety in a thunderstorm environment. Distance is your friend for several reasons. You don't want to get up too close to cells. The nature of those cells are that they could throw hail out of the top, and the hail might be descending some distance from the storm. If there are numerous cells, air mass type storms around, you don't want to pass too closely between cells, because you may find on the other side there's another cell and you don't have an escape route any longer. So you want wide berth to maneuver. And of course, in that kind of environment, you also want to know where airports are.
Wally, tell us the avoidance procedures and regulations you had with the airline. For once again, these are, you know, big boys flying big equipment, and you had some pretty strict guidelines.
Big airplanes nailed together pretty well with radar and lots of other things to tactically get around those thunderstorms. But in our case, if the temperature was above freezing and we were at low altitude, 5 miles minimum distance to a thunderstorm. That meant if you were going between two, you need a 10-mile hole. If the temperature was below freezing, we had a 10-mile limit. So now we need a 20-mile hole between thunderstorms. And if we were above 25,000, it went to 20 miles. It takes a 40-mile hole.
Good numbers to keep in mind. Nice to have these planning tools, because this exercise we're talking about here is all about having a good plan and having options to allow that plan to flow and to move. Because quite frankly, we have air mass thunderstorms and we have lines of thunderstorms. So we may have a line of thunderstorms, I mean, hundreds of miles long. You're not going to go around it. You know, in the airplanes we're talking about here, you're not going to go over them and you're not going to go under them. It's just not going to work for you on that day. But the air mass thunderstorms, okay, they might be isolated and you might be able to work around them. You may be able to see them visually. But we need to understand thunderstorms is it's one word. The discussion thereof, you know, you really need more information. You know, what are the nature of these thunderstorms? What's causing them? How big are they? You know, how much of an area are we talking about? We're talking here about, okay, we want to plan a route around these thunderstorms. Well, that may take you a couple of days or a couple of hours.
Yeah. And remember, going over the tops of thunderstorms is not the solution, not for any airplane. I'm sure, Bob and Wally, you've seen storms that you've passed at 40 or 45,000 feet that were literally towering over you. Mm-hmm. Huge amount of convection there, and that's where those updrafts come from. Yeah. That's what takes an airplane apart, makes pieces.
Exactly. You know, we need to recognize while we're talking about dealing with these things and going around them and approaching them, that this phenomena has the ability to take an airplane apart, Bob.
It has on countless occasions.
And we need to be thinking about that every time we see one of those out there.
Let's talk a little bit about wind shear, truly one of the factors associated with a thunderstorm. But, you know, how well do we understand it, and what data is available for us? John, you've worked with a bunch of wind shear systems. What can we expect in the vicinity of an airport with regard to getting some wind shear alerts, and how can we use what's out there for us to our best advantage?
Well, Bob, as I said before, there are certain airports that have low-level wind shear alert systems, but there's only just about 45 right now out of 450 towered airports, and what do we have, about 4,000 non-towered airports throughout the country. Granted, given that, the ones with the system, the controller is required to provide the information, and you can certainly solicit if you see it. But airports without it, you may be able to get some information from the one-minute weather. The airport has AWAS, ASOS, where you could listen to that, and you can listen for a change in surface wind. But a lot of it is going to be what you do with that information, too. The controller can only provide you with a wind shear alert. Can't fly the airplane, can't tell you which way to go or what you're going to have to do with it.
But we should probably talk a little bit about what wind shear is and how it's manifested on the approach to the runway.
And departure.
And departure,
it can
exactly.
Can be just as bad on departure.
Could be just as bad, probably.
Sometimes even worse.
Absolutely. Absolute issue on both approach and departure, for the simple reason that you're close to the ground. And what you will see in a wind shear is a rapid fluctuation in airspeed. Now, if that airspeed fluctuates to the point where it brings you down towards the stall speed of the airplane and you do not respond, your airplane is going to start sinking, and it's going to be very difficult to recover without hitting the ground if you're only at an altitude of 100 or 200 feet.
And it may not even be a great change in velocity. It can be a change in direction. If you're planning on landing on a runway that was the active runway was into the wind, and all of a sudden you encounter a tailwind or quartering tailwind.
Those are the worst wind shears.
It may not even be that strong. It may only be 10 knots or something, but when you go from a headwind to a tailwind,
there's 20 knots.
Yeah.
And, good point, John.
And, and you're landing on a wet runway. Mm-hmm. And so.
Now, our rules on a wind shear, of course, we have onboard wind shear detection. It'll tell you wind shear is to go around, not to try to deal with it, because you don't know what the effects are going to be and how what kind of sink you're going to see. So anything that indicates wind shear, such as a stick shaker or a wind shear alert, go around. Now, in our light aircraft that we're flying, where are we going to see that? We're going to see it on an airspeed fluctuation. So best thing to do there is apply full power if you don't already have it in, as in the case of departure. Go around, set up your approach again, and not try to salvage a situation at, let's say, 50, 100, or 200 feet above the ground where airspeed is going crazy on you.
This is one area where simulators have been truly invaluable, because you don't ever want to go out and practice flying in wind shear conditions. But in a simulator, I know Wally and I have seen it dramatically, it can absolutely overpower the airplane. And so the beauty of that is that we have to work in the mindset, just as you said beautifully, Bob. It's not about trying to fly through this. Wind shear is get out of dodge information. I mean, that's what that wind shear means. Wind shear is not, okay, noted. Wind shear is I'm out of here. Because it can and will overpower your airplane.
Absolutely.
And it's done it to a lot bigger airplanes than we're talking about flying here.
Absolutely. I've seen it in the sims where even at full power, the airplane continues to sink. And in fact, on my last sim run, the airplane actually hit the ground and bounced off of the ground at full power with both engines at max power. It's just unbelievable what can happen as the airplane gets pushed down. And that could be part of the effect of a microburst as well.
True.
Not only is it wind shear, but through the middle of the microburst, there's downforce on the airplane. Mm-hmm.
That's right. You know, having said this, let's just focus for a second on the nature of this trip. You're going home. And yes, you know, the camp is on the horizon, and we always have something on the horizon. You know, us pilots are busy people, don't you know? Well, you know, you got a little bit of pressure to get home, and you got a thunderstorm. You know, how compatible are those two things?
Well, ultimately, you may wind up driving through the thunderstorm, which is a whole lot better than flying through it. And that may be, you know, the graceful way out of this. If we get halfway and we just got to park it and get a rental car.
There's always tomorrow to fly the plane.
Yep.